This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Before 2018 draws to a close, we're highlighting some of the Where We Live conversations that have stayed with us. This show gives me the opportunity to interview really interesting people who are doing important work. Some of them remind us not to forget the contributions of Connecticut residents, like Constance Baker Motley. Later, we'll hear from Dr. Gary Ford Jr. about his book on Baker Motley, who once lived in New Haven. She was a civil rights attorney for the NAACP in the 1960s, and later became the first Black woman to serve as a federal judge. First, we reflect on the history of this place we call home. A history that's not often discussed. Connecticut beaches are one of the state's most beautiful assets, but not everyone gets equal access to them. I spoke with author Andrew Carl about his book on a local activist who fought to open up Connecticut's shoreline to everyone, especially minority youth. The book is called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what drew you to focus in on this history of privatization on Connecticut's shoreline?
Yeah, I've always been interested in looking at the history of inequality and land use in America and understanding the sort of relationship between the two, and also the sort of history of environmental injustice. And Ned Cole is a person who really sort of brought these issues into focus. And that was sort of what ultimately drew me to his story, and also just the sort of how captivating he was as an individual and how many sort of critical issues that his organization raised during that time.
Well, where did you grow up, Andrew? Is this something, when you said you've always been interested in these issues, something that you noticed growing up?
You know, I grew up in Ohio, so far from the coast, but nevertheless had been always drawn to beaches and coastal areas as a particularly fragile environmental resource, but also one that has experienced profound change as a result of development. And also the kind of, you know, the tension between that desire for openness, the sense that beaches belong to everyone versus the reality, which is that in America today, many coastal areas are very exclusive and exclusionary to the general public.
So if we look at history, you know, when did this push for privatizing beach access in Connecticut and other places really take off?
You know, it began in Connecticut very early, and in many respects, Connecticut was sort of a trendsetter in the move toward privatizing shorelines. Really, in the early 1900s, you began to see the proliferation of private beach associations up and down the shorelines, and these are sort of a forerunner to the modern gated community in that they are sort of governed, have a sort of private form of governance, and also sort of privatized public space, namely their beaches. So that was, in a sense, a sort of a trend that we began to see spread across the U.S. Really in the post-World War II decades, but in Connecticut it began much earlier in the early 20th century.
Here in Connecticut, many of us are familiar with the term Gold Coast, and we'll be talking more about that part of the state in a little bit. But when we look at the people that were part of these beach associations, they weren't all the super wealthy, were they?
No, not at all. I mean, that was actually the model that sort of was developed in the early 20th century was one that would sort of had prefabricated communities that would really allow for, say, middle class white families to be able to own a second home. Many of these beach associations, especially in the eastern half of the state, were often identified with either religious or ethnic groups. There's the Irish beach, the Italian beach, the Jewish beach. But, you know, this is, so in a sense, it was not all very super wealthy folks, but it was also very exclusionary. All of these beach associations invariably were governed by racial covenants that barred the sale of lots to African Americans. So, you know, even though it was these were not all, you know, very wealthy communities, they were ones that were very much off limits to a segment of the state's population.
And when we look at Connecticut's coast, we're looking at more than 200 miles of shoreline. But how much of that was actually open to anyone, Andrew?
You know, less than around seven miles of it was considered generally open to the public, and the rest was either in the hands of private homeowners or were public beaches that were really public in name only. They were many communities restricted their public beaches to residents only or placed severe restrictions on the ability of non-residents to be able to actually access them. So as a result, by the time you get to the 1960s and 70s, when my story really begins, there's very few places along the state shoreline that a person, say, living in Hartford or elsewhere in the state who wasn't fortunate enough to be able to own a home along the shore, there was very few places that they could actually go to enjoy the shoreline.
And you mentioned in your book these were the result of what's called exclusionary zoning, keeping certain people out of specific areas, beach associations and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, exclusionary zoning was really the sort of chief mechanism of segregation across the state and really throughout the Northeast. I mean, you have communities that often zoned land in a way that made it next to impossible for low-income people to live in their communities. I mean, in Greenwich, for instance, over one-third of the entire town was zoned at four-acre lots minimum, so that you had to have your house on a four-acre lot to be able to even live there. And this was a sort of pattern that we saw throughout the state, is that you had really areas of concentrated affluence that was kind of locked in, and as a result, people of modest means really had no ability to move into communities because of local zoning ordinances.
This is Where We Live. With us from a studio at University of Virginia is Andrew Carl. He's an associate professor of history and African American studies and the author of this new book, Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Andrew, tell us about Ned. So he grew up in Hartford, born to an Irish immigrant. What's his story?
Yeah, Ned grew up the life of a sort of comfortable middle class white American living in post-war America. He went to Fairfield University, graduated with honors, and was sort of living the dream, as his parents envisioned. He returned to Hartford and got a job in the insurance industry. He was all sort of set to live that sort of middle class life of comfort. And then he made a very sharp detour.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the factors that led him to that detour. So, his mother in the book you write, she always hoped that he would have a comfortable life working in the insurance industry. But when he went to Fairfield University, he started to meet some people who challenged the notions that he grew up with, one being an African-American professor.
Yeah, Walter Petrie, who was a professor at Fairfield and was also, he, as Ned described, really opened his eyes to the problem of racism in America and inequality. And he did so through taking groups of students down to Harlem and walking them through the neighborhood, getting them acquainted with the culture, with the the community, as well as the struggles, and got them to sort of see firsthand African-American life and culture and urban inequality, not just sort of talking about it in a classroom. And I think that really stuck with Ned, the idea of sort of direct engagement, communication on a sort of interpersonal level, as opposed to sort of intellectualizing these problems.
And he went on to graduate from Fairfield and work in the insurance industry. But there was another point that made him kind of question what he was doing with his life, and that was when JFK was assassinated.
Yeah, I mean, John F. Kennedy was someone who was very influential to him. He really looked up to him, as a sort of young Irish-American Catholic. And his death really sort of led Ned to sort of question what he was doing in life. And, he had long been struck by that sort of call to service that Kennedy had issued with his inaugural address. And, after his death, he began to ask himself what he was doing to help contribute to making this a more engaged, less cynical country. And that was when he decided to quit his job and start this sort of domestic peace corps, as he described it, called Revitalization Corps.
And we're going to learn more about the Revitalization Corps in just a little bit. But I'm curious, Andrew, what the reaction was of his family to this change in his life, especially his mother. You have an interesting anecdote in your book.
They were not too pleased, his mother in particular. I mean, again, she was someone who very much sort of wanted him to sort of live a very conventional life, and was horrified by his decision to, you know, quit a job, that, you know, very, you know, promising career, and start, you know, this sort of anti-poverty organization that was in particular addressing problems of racism and in seeking to engage and work with the city's African-American communities, to the point where she had concluded that he had literally sort of, you know, lost his mind. She actually had him committed to a state mental hospital after he had made this decision. That was how sort of fiercely opposed she was. And she actually blamed Walter Petrie, the professor who she thought had poisoned her son's mind in college, for his decision.
Much of the Connecticut shoreline was once off limits to people, unless you lived in a shore town or belonged to a beach association. Today, we're learning about the fight to open beaches to the public. Connecticut resident Ned Cole helped bring awareness to the issue beginning in the 1960s. And our guest today is Andrew Carl, author of a new book called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. He joins us today from a studio at the University of Virginia. Up next, we're going to learn more about how Cole's campaign was received by shore towns. Do you remember the fight to open up Connecticut's beaches? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. We're learning about Ned Cole, a Connecticut resident and anti-poverty activist that worked to make Connecticut's shoreline accessible to all. Author Andrew Carl documents his efforts in his new book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Andrew's joining us from the studio at University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And there's an excerpt of his book on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Andrew, we were talking about Ned Cole leaving this his career of working in insurance to form the Revitalization Corps, similar to the Peace Corps. But talk us through how he went about doing that and getting people to buy into what he was the message that he was trying to relay.
Yeah, I mean, as you said at the outset, I mean, he was very much focused on waging a war on apathy, in particular waging that in the suburbs, you know, amongst the middle class whites and, you know, in West Hartford and other suburbs that had sort of really left the city and, as he saw it, abandoned its African-American community and Puerto Rican communities. And he really wanted to sort of engage with them and sort of find ways to sort of build bridges of communication that could combat the sort of vicious, cancerous stereotypes that many suburban whites had of urban America and particularly of African-American communities.
And he started by opening up an office. And what about the, I guess, the connection to Harlem when he would go there? So did he start in Harlem and then work in Hartford?
Yeah, so he, you know, he started by opening up a storefront in Hartford, and he put in, you know, he put classifieds in the newspaper calling on folks to volunteer their time. You know, he said, you know, just 3 hours a week, either tutoring, working on helping young African-American men find jobs, other a variety of activities. So it was very much sort of the moment, trying to respond to immediate needs. But then he also, it began to grow rapidly. You know, many national publications began to write stories on Revitalization Corps, and chapters began to spread across. Soon he opened up a chapter in Harlem and he sort of spent many years going back and forth between Hartford and Harlem. But then others who were inspired by his call to service opened up their own chapters on college campuses and in cities ranging from Miami, Florida, all the way out to Watts, L.A.
Well, how did African-Americans look at Ned Cole and think, you know, who is this guy coming into our neighborhoods? And I'm curious, you mentioned he was trying to reach out to whites in places like West Hartford. Were they skeptical?
Yeah, I mean, initially there was a lot of skepticism as to what Ned was doing in on the north end of Hartford. I mean, but I think, you know, he really was able to win the confidence and affection really of many in the community just by being himself and really spending time getting to know people in a sort of, you know, sincere manner. You know, he really didn't come in with any agenda or any assumptions, but really just spent a lot of time listening, engaging, you know, sort of rapping with folks on the street, in barbershops, in their homes, and also really expecting the same of the suburban whites who volunteered with Revitalization Corps. You know, families who who participated in this were expected to go into the north end of Hartford, get to meet family, African-American families in their homes, as opposed to just simply having them come to the suburbs. So it was very much about sort of breaking down these divisions on a sort of interpersonal level.
Meanwhile, there's a lot of unrest happening in U.S. cities, also here in Hartford, with how African Americans were treated, where they were subjected to live. Can you walk us through some of how that unrest helped fuel some of the activism and why people wanted to follow Ned Cole and into this group?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as you probably know, I mean, many of the listeners know, you know, the 1960s and the summers in the 1960s were a particular time of racial unrest in American cities. Hartford, in particular, was racked by an uprising often referred to as a riot in the summer of 67, Harlem in 1964. And this was a time in particular, and this is kind of how Ned also kind of gravitated toward the issue of recreational inequality. Many of these incidents were sparked by conflicts over outdoor recreational space. But also, you know, as he saw, underlying many of the grievances of African American communities was this issue of recreational deprivation. The fact that you know, public officials didn't seem to care about the fact that many inner city children lacked safe places to play. In Hartford in particular, there was a shockingly high number of drowning deaths of black youth in the city, in particular along a stretch of the Park River that was close to two housing projects. And the sort of response of public officials was complete indifference. And this was something that really was one of the sort of issues that was fueling unrest, and ultimately the Kerner Commission that, you know, issued its report in 1968 identified recreational inequality as one of the sort of high levels of grievance that was common across many of the riot-torn cities in America.
You mentioned the Kerner Commission. This was the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, the Kerner Commission releasing this report on urban violence in 1968. So when that report came out, I mean, if Ned Cole wasn't there with his group, the Revitalization Corps, again, bringing awareness to the disparities, is this something that would have just been buried?
You know, I mean, you know, Ned was someone who sort of thought that the Kerner Commission report should be read by every American. I mean, you know, he thought that this should be gospel, you know, that this would be something that would help sort of awaken, in particular, those suburban white families who had seemed to sort of become cold and indifferent to the problems of urban America, that by reading that and understanding the lessons of it, we could begin to work towards solutions. So he really was proselytized on the importance of the Kerner Commission and what its findings really said to all America.
He was encouraging the armchair activists to actually do something and not just talk about it in their homes and with the people they know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as he described himself, he was someone who believed in gut liberalism, not the sort of kind that, you know, you would see happen in a college classroom or, result in position papers or other sort of statements. It was manifest through action. And it came from the gut. It came from instinct. And that was something that sort of guided him throughout this time period, was the idea that, you know, we don't have time to sit around and talk about these issues. We need to sort of engage on a direct level and help improve people's lives and work toward a better country.
Now, how did Ned Cole gravitate toward beach access from spending time, again, highlighting the disparities and the issues of poverty within neighborhoods and cities?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, in a sense, almost by accident. I mean, you know, as one of the many initiatives that Revitalization Corps was leading, was one that was aimed at sort of providing summer recreational options for African-American children living on the north end of Hartford. And one of the sort of ideas that he came up with was to rent a van and bring a group of kids down to the shoreline. He didn't think of this as a protest at all. He just thought that this would be a good, activity. And many of the African-American mothers who were critical in the work that Revitalization Corps did were very strongly in support of it as well. You know, they wanted to see their children get these type of, you know, enrichment activities and the types of recreation that the rest of Americans seem to sort of, you know, consider a sort of rite of childhood. And so they sort of, you know, started this initiative to start, sending children to the shore. But when they got there, they discovered that there was nowhere they could go.
because there were so many private areas due to beach associations that had been formed along these shore towns?
Yeah, exactly. And even the public beaches, with the exception of the state beaches at Hammonasset, there were very few places that were open to the general public. And also, he really wanted to sort of engage with the folks who lived and vacationed along the shoreline. He envisioned, sort of had a very rosy image of white and black children playing together and white and black parents talking and realizing their common humanity and finding sort of ways to begin to break down those stereotypes. He thought that leisure spaces and leisure activities could actually be a vehicle for building a more integrated society. But as he discovered, the white folks who lived along these shorelines were not interested in that at all. In fact, they were not greeted warmly at all.
Andrew Carl, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Virginia, author of the new book, Free the Beaches, A Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. We should say that he wasn't able to join us due to health issues, Ned Cole. But Andrew, we're talking through your book. You did a lot of research on what led Ned Cole to try to free the beaches and raise awareness. So I'm curious if you could walk us through some of the first incidents when he rented the buses and went to a particular beach in Old Lyme, for example.
Yeah, and he became really radicalized on this issue after a particularly negative incident in Old Lyme in the summer of 1971 when they came to one of the private beaches along the shoreline and were received very hostile reactions from residents, racist sort of epithets being thrown at the parents and children. And at that moment, he really was, it opened his eyes to the extent of the problem and of the sort of pervasive racism among many of the families who lived along the shore. And at that point, he began to realize this issue of beach access was about more than just the beach itself. In fact, it was very much a kind of issue about the public's right to public space and about the sort of structural barriers that had been sort of put up along the shoreline and throughout society that prevented African Americans from freely participating in these sort of things that many Americans also enjoyed.
You write in your book, whenever there were efforts to pass legislation to protect the coast or to maybe make the local autonomy less strict, there was a big backlash. So politicians weren't getting anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think I discovered in the course of doing research for this was how privatization and the sort of exclusionary culture that we began to, you saw in many of these communities was not just sort of antisocial and wasn't just sort of, didn't just have effects on, on society, but was also environmentally destructive because it resulted in measures that were often, very damaging to the shoreline itself and also, sort of led to the a sort of political culture that was resistant to regulation out of fear that, regulatory bodies, whether they be state or federal, might undermine the ability of private homeowners or beach communities to restrict access. And so as a result, you began to see efforts to really sort of either prevent legislation or really sort of gut regulatory agencies' ability to manage shorelines in the interest of environmental protection and in the interest of the public.
Andrew Carl is with us from the University of Virginia, author of this book, Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. So while Ned and the RC and little kids were trying to raise awareness by visiting these beaches as a protest, this was also making its way through the courts. And was there any success in opening the beaches for people in Connecticut?
Well, not during the time when Ned was most active on the issue. It didn't come until 2001, and it was as a result of a lawsuit filed by a law student named Brendan Layden, who was stopped when trying to jog through Greenwich's beach because he was a non-resident. And they said that non-residents were not allowed on the shoreline, and he decided to sue the town, challenging the constitutionality, both on the grounds of the public trust doctrine that, you know, states that the shoreline is public property, but also on the basis of free speech rights, that they were restricting his right to free speech and association. So that worked its way through the courts in the late 1990s, and ultimately the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in 2001 that towns like Greenwich could not restrict public beaches to residents only.
Now, because they couldn't restrict them, shore towns, other places, especially Greenwich, found different ways to try to restrict non-residents. What were some of those tactics?
Yeah, I mean, they really sort of resisted and sought to undermine the spirit of that decision ever since, and continue to do so, either through removing public parking spaces or making parking lots near the shoreline open to residents only, putting in place a whole cumbersome set of requirements in order to purchase a beach pass. So, for instance, in Greenwich, to buy a beach pass, you have to go to the opposite side of the town in some city office building that's not even open on the weekends in order to buy a beach pass. I mean, really putting in place just a number of hoops that are all meant to sort of dissuade, and if not make it, practically impossible for outsiders to get in.
What is Ned Cole's legacy today, Andrew?
Well, I think, the legacy is one, you can see it in the lives of people like Liebert and many others who are really touched and really affected by the work that he did in the community. I would say also, on the issue of his activism, I think it's a cautionary tale for, the need for activists to form partnerships and collaborate and form coalitions and not sort of allow, a sort of issue or a movement to become too reliant on one individual. Because, Ned sort of, he marched to the beat of his own drum often, and he sort of resisted the kind of sort of, building coalitions with other groups and organizations to the point when his health began to suffer in the 1980s, when he sort of, reached retirement years, it was difficult to sort of continue the work of Revitalization Corps as a result.
Andrew Carl, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies, also author of this book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up, we learn about Constance Baker Motley. The New Haven resident was a civil rights attorney who argued several cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. More after this short break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Constance Baker Motley was a pioneer in many ways, first serving as a civil rights attorney in the 1960s, where she won several defining desegregation cases. She would later become the first Black woman to serve as a federal judge. My guest is Dr. Gary Ford Jr., who's written a book about the New Haven native called Constance Baker Motley, One Woman's Fight for Civil Rights and Equal Justice Under Law. Gary, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, when did you first hear about Constance Baker Motley?
I first heard about Constance Baker Motley when I was a little tyke growing up in New Canaan, Connecticut. I grew up in a family of lawyers, and growing up in New Canaan in the early 80s, there actually weren't that many Black attorneys, actually in all of Connecticut. So it was a small circle. Through that small circle, I met Connie Royster, who is Judge Motley's niece. And she, in turn, introduced me to Judge Motley.
She passed away in 2005 after you met her. And again, you knew about her story through your family's connections. What made you then write a book about her later on?
It's a couple reasons. First of all, when I was at Harvard, I was studying African-American studies. And I was focusing on the civil rights movement because that was my interest. And I was reading about all of these cases, these desegregation cases that really were crucial for the movement. And I remember hearing her talking about these cases as a child. And I was like, well, we have James Meredith, we have Charlene Hunter Gall, we have Hamilton Holmes. But there's no mention of the woman who actually represented them and actually won those cases and gained them entry to those universities. So that struck me as a bit odd. And I began to learn that the African-American history that I was learning was incomplete. You know, we have this traditional narrative of the civil rights movement that tends to focus mostly on black men, usually in the clergy, and it does not have enough space for other alternative leaders who did crucial things for the movement, but because they're not in that traditional leadership role, they are kind of overlooked.
Women like Constance Baker Motley, who were overlooked. Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Ford Jr., who's written a book about this Connecticut native. She was raised in New Haven. The book is Constance Baker Motley, One Woman's Fight for Civil Rights and Equal Justice Under Law. I was curious about her upbringing. Can we start there? She was born in New Haven. Tell us about her family.
Yes, her family, I think, informed her worldview very much so. Her parents were from Nevis. They were immigrants. A typical immigrant story. You move to the United States. You try to work your way up and make a better life for your children. So her mother was a stay-at-home mom, and her father was a chef. He was a cook, which was one of the few occupations that was open to black men at that time period. And he worked at some of the prominent Yale eating clubs, including the Skull and Bone Society. So she grew up in a large family. She's one of 12 siblings, and her time in New Haven, she described it as fairly free of racism, except for a few incidences, which is not to say that New Haven was perfect at the time she grew up there, but it was far preferable to what was going on in the South at that time.
So in New Haven, there was a lot of West Indians that were living in the part of the city that her family also lived?
Yes.
And how did that play a role in her upbringing and where the family hung out, the church they belonged to?
She went to St. Luke's Episcopal Church. She grew up around a lot of West Indians, as you said, particularly ones of who were under British rule. So a very similar shared culture, you know, this reserved nature that's typical of people coming from, say, Barbados or Nevis or Jamaica. So that was kind of provided a buffer for her because she had this this community and the support network that was beyond her family. And I think that allowed her to kind of grow up not experiencing some of the biases that other people might have been experiencing in New Haven at that time.
So she was growing up in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
Again, New Haven was a diverse city of immigrants.
Yes.
And when was her first time where she noticed discrimination because of the color of her skin?
The first time was when she went with a group of friends. It was a diverse group of friends, and they went to go swim. At the beach, and her friends were allowed in, and yet she was denied entry to that beach, a place of public accommodation because of the color of her skin. And that really struck her as the first time when she really felt that she was being othered, and that was had a profound effect on her later in life.
When did she first get a glimpse of the fact that, you know, women could be attorneys, too? Because at that time, there weren't very many women, if at all, practicing law. Who were her role models?
Yes, hardly any. There were two black women in particular who she knew of in childhood that kind of gave her the courage to pursue her dreams. You know, usually if you see somebody who looks like you is doing something, then that makes it possible for you to do it. Those two women were Eunice Hunton Carter and Jane Boland, who both worked in New York. I think one was appointed by Dewey, the other was appointed by LaGuardia. And so she knew of these women, and so she knew it was possible for a black woman to become a lawyer.
What about her family? Did they think it was possible for Constance to become a lawyer?
That's an interesting question. Her mother actually, when she told her mother she wanted to be a lawyer, her mother told her that you're better off becoming a hairdresser. So that's a bit of a discouragement right there. But you have to remember, at this time period, becoming a lawyer was kind of like saying, I want to become, you know, an astronaut. It was something that was not in the realm of possibility for, you know, a black woman, because there hadn't been hardly any of them. So her mother was really trying to protect her from, you know, the disappointment of not being able to fulfill her dreams. And in so doing, happened to discourage her. But of course, Judge Motley being who she was, she wasn't going to take discouragement lying down.
She wanted to go on to college, but was it difficult for her family to afford college at that time? And how did she get an in, so to speak?
Yes. So being one of 12 children and also with a single income household, it was very difficult for them to afford college. And in fact, she couldn't afford college just based on her family. We didn't have all the scholarships that are available now. And so she took jobs through Eleanor Roosevelt, her national youth program. So she was doing that. She was refurnishing furniture. And she was also becoming engaged in politics locally, civic engagement locally. And she spoke up at a meeting to this white philanthropist named Clarence Blakeslee. And basically, he had built a community center for African Americans to use in New Haven and was concerned.
Dixwell Avenue?
Yes.
Dixwell Avenue?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And was concerned that they weren't using it. And none of the black people wanted to tell him that the reason they weren't using it was because there's no black people on the board and they didn't feel like they had any representation. So that's why it wasn't being used. Constance Baker Motley, being one who always would speak truth to power, actually stood up at this community meeting and said it over the gasps of some people in the audience because they thought that was quite rude. But he found it refreshing and found her to be very mature and very wise for her age. And so he decided that he was going to fund her education as far as she wanted to go. And that's how she got to go to college and then law school.
She made the decision to pursue a college degree down south.
Yes.
Why did she want to do it there?
I think she wanted to experience black culture and go to an all-black university. And at the time, those were in the south. And so she got down to Fisk, and when she got down there, riding on the Jim Crow car and some of the aspects of southern life, she felt was a really hard adjustment. So she didn't end up finishing at Fisk. She finished up at NYU.
Now, you said that she transferred up to NYU and then eventually to Columbia Law School. So one of the first moments in her career where she was a first there, too.
Yes. She was one of the first black women at Columbia Law School. Her firsts are many. And she basically, when she got to Columbia Law School, she started working at the LDF. She's the first woman working there. Clarence Blakeslee actually Legal Defense Fund. NAACP Legal Defense Fund, sorry. Clarence Blakeslee had actually hoped to set her up with a position at a Wall Street firm after she finished law school, but she informed him that she was going to go work for the LDF instead.
And she met Thurgood Marshall. Tell me about what that was like for her.
She had great admiration for Thurgood Marshall. He, from a very, very early on in their relationship, he began to give her significant responsibility. Matter of fact, she drafted one of the complaints that it became Brown versus Board of Education. So they, all of the members of the LDF, were very open in allowing her to assume responsibility and actually go down south and be lead counsel on many of these cases that she argued.
Why were they open to her as a woman, as an attorney? Because, again, she's one of the first, and during that time, a lot of women weren't in these roles. Why were they accepting of her?
I think even though a lot of these were men of their times, they recognized her talent. While she was even still in law school before she had graduated, her work was exemplary, and I think the LDF was not so well-funded as to where they could basically squander talent such as hers by having her perform secretarial duties or something else like that, which wouldn't really maximize her talents.
This is where we live. Speaking with Dr. Gary Ford, Jr., Assistant Professor of Africana Studies at Lehman College, also author of Constance Baker Motley, One Woman's Fight for Civil Rights and Equal Justice Under Law. As we're learning today, Constance was a New Haven native, and she is one of the unsung women of the civil rights movement. Let's talk about Dr. Ford, Gary, about Constance Baker Motley's contribution to that historic desegregation case, Brown versus Board. Tell us about her role in that.
Yeah, so Brown versus Board was towards the early end of her career at the LDF, but she was one of the attorneys who was working on that case and actually drafted one of the complaints that was merged into Brown versus Board of Education. Because there was a few different cases that were merged into one for Brown 1 and then Brown 2.
Now, when she did that work, you mentioned earlier that Thurgood Marshall, the team, felt comfortable sending her down south to do a lot of the grassroots work and to meet and talk to the people. What was that like for her as a Black woman, as an attorney, and how did the segregationist react to her?
Well, I think there's this notion that a Black woman being down south would be in less danger than a Black man, even though the history doesn't really back that up. I think Thurgood Marshall and some of the other male attorneys at the LDF had made the argument. As a matter of fact, she says this in her autobiography, that she would have a better time in these southern courts because all white men had Black mammies, I think was the quote. You know, a mammy being a slave woman who would take care of the master's family, cook and take care of the kids, and was not seen as very threatening. In reality, regardless of gender, if you went down south, even regardless of race in many cases, if you went down south and you were agitating and disrupting the way of life, the segregationist way of life, your life was in danger. We have countless examples of Black men, Black women, white men, white women being assaulted or killed down south trying to do the work of integration.
So who kept her safe?
When she was down south in Mississippi, in Georgia, in Alabama, working all these school desegregation cases, there were local members of the NAACP who would act as bodyguards because they couldn't count on the police to provide protection for her.
Because some of those police were members of the Klan?
Yes. Some of them were moonlighting in white bedsheets. That's just fact. And the local FBI was also had some, sometimes they were had their biases as well. So it was mostly private security. The NAACP, but also sympathetic whites who were working with the NAACP and wanted to see segregation end in their communities.
She also worked with the community in Birmingham during the Children's Crusade. So when all of these children, these thousands of students, Black students who were trained in nonviolent demonstrations to desegregate the city of Birmingham, talk us through her role there and how she worked with more well-known figures in the civil rights movement, including Dr. King.
Yes. She represented Dr. King personally a few times, got him out of jail a few times. In the Birmingham schools case, she was really critical to his ascension as a leader of the civil rights movement because in that school's case, they had planned a march on Sunday. And somebody else who actually his name escapes my mind right now had convinced Dr. King to include children in that march. And so they included the children. And then, of course, the police responded with hoses and dogs. And the children were harassed in that way and then also arrested en masse, thousands of kids arrested. And while they were in jail, they were also expelled from schools. And the parents weren't going to stand for that. I mean, it's one thing for them to go through the trials and tribulations of trying to integrate, but to have their children suffer in that manner and maybe not ever graduate was too much for them. So she was sent down south to get them out of jail and then also get them back in school to get an injunction to prevent their expulsion. And she was able to do that. And because she was able to do that, it restored the faith of the parents in the movement, and they continued to support Dr. King, whereas otherwise they might not have.
She went on to represent Dr. King in other struggles. How did he view her?
He was a great admirer of Constance Baker Motley. As a matter of fact, later on, when she was up for federal judgeship, Dr. King was one of the people that LBJ called to get a sense of who Constance Baker Motley was. So he felt that he owed her a debt, not only for that Birmingham schools case, but also for getting him out of jail a few times, America's Georgia and a couple other places.
When was the breaking point for her where she moved on with her career and couldn't do this work anymore?
That's a complicated issue. Basically, at the LDF, she'd been at the LDF for a while and won all of these segregation cases. But when the time came to pick a replacement for Thurgood Marshall, who was going to the bench, they actually selected Jack Greenberg, who was a fantastic lawyer and, you know, has done a lot for civil rights. However, Judge Motley had actually been there longer than him, and her record was equally distinguished, if not more so. I can't think of somebody who had argued and won more civil rights cases, especially school segregation cases, than her. On the one hand, I think Thurgood Marshall and Bob Carter were having a bit of a feud at this time because Thurgood Marshall was focusing most of his efforts on fundraising, which is great. I mean, without money, you don't have the resources mm-hmm. to argue these cases. But Bob Carter felt like most of the legal work was falling on his shoulders. So he wanted Thurgood Marshall to focus more on that. And so they had a rift, and Thurgood Marshall wanted to put somebody in who was more in line with his philosophy, and that was Jack Greenberg. So he moved very quickly to install Jack Greenberg as his successor, whereas Bob Carter was supporting Constance Baker Motley. And so was Medgar Evers, who was her biggest cheerleader for that position and was very upset when she didn't get it. So there is a politics involved. I think also we have to look at these are men of their time. Even though they gave her vast amounts of responsibility and really nurtured her to be a civil rights lawyer, I think they might have also been uncomfortable at that time with having a woman in the top chair. And, so I think gender also played a role in her being passed over.
She would leave the Legal Defense Fund, eventually becoming the first black woman to serve in the New York State Senate. And then she got a call from the White House. What happened?
Yes. So while she's in the New York State Senate, she became aligned with Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was actually the one who initially put her name in for a judgeship. However, they had a falling out when she supported a candidate which he did not support. And I guess he felt that she was going to basically rubber stamp whatever he wanted because he was a Kennedy. But we know from a very early age that Motley is going to speak her truth no matter what. So after that, it seemed as if Kennedy was sitting on her nomination. And that's when LBJ heard about her. And at this time, LBJ and Bobby Kennedy were frenemies. You know, there's a rivalry there. So LBJ took it upon himself to nominate her to the federal bench. And then after he did so, he called Bobby Kennedy and asked if he wanted to be the first one to congratulate her.
At the time, there were some who opposed her nomination because of sexism?
Yes. So early on in her career, I think race was much more of a factor when she was going down south. I mean, gender was still an issue. But later on in New York, when she was being appointed to the bench, it became more about her gender. So originally, LBJ wanted to nominate her to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. They're the ones who hear all the big Wall Street cases. It's a very prestigious appointment, and the white men who were there did not want a woman on that court. So they were against that, and they had to compromise by nominating her to the Southern District Court in New York. However, there's also was some issues that she had to face there with regard to sexism.
Because you've done so much research and you understand a lot about her life and what drove her to do the things that she did, when we look at America today, what do you think would be Judge Motley's opinion of some of the movements happening today, whether it's Black Lives Matter or what's going on in politics today?
Well, I think she probably would be disappointed with the tribalism going on in politics right now, the divisiveness. I think she was a great believer in people seeing the common, the things we have in common as opposed to our differences. So in the age now where we're having to deal with people who love to be in echo chambers and love to focus on what other people have and taking that away because they think they'll benefit more from that, I think she would be disappointed in that. She would, however, I think, be very encouraged by some of these movements that are going on. You have Black Lives Matter movement, which is a civil rights organization that's actually created and run by mostly women. I think she would find that to be very compelling. You also have the Never Again movement going on nationwide now. It started in Florida. That is also has, I'm not going to say women, but girls actually up front and leading and speaking their truth. So I think she would be very encouraged about that. And I think she would also be encouraged with what seems like a wave of new politicians who are coming to challenge the politics as usual going on right now. And I think she would be hopeful with regard to that.
I want to thank Dr. Gary Ford, Jr., Assistant Professor of Africana Studies at Lehman College, author of the book Constance Baker Motley, One Woman's Fight for Civil Rights and Equal Justice Under Law. Again, she was a New Haven native, a daughter of immigrants, accomplished so much, became a first in many facets. I should mention that she also was the first woman to serve as the Chief Justice of the District Court for the Southern District of New York, and she assumed that senior status until her death in 2005. Thank you, Gary, so much for coming in and telling us about Constance Baker Motley.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Carmen Baskoff. Check out wmpr.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.